ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय।
श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 11 चैप्टर 10 द नेचर ऑफ फ्रूट ऑफ एक्टिविटी टेक्स्ट 14 थ्रू 16। We'll chant the first one responsibly, even though all three of them are together here. Word meanings for verse 14. Atta, thus, esham, of those. Karma, fruit of activities. Kartrinam, of the performers. Bhoktrinam, of the enjoyers. Sukha dukhayo, of happiness and distress. Nanatvam, variegatedness. Atha, moreover, nityatvam, perpetual existence, loka, of the materialistic world, kala, material time, agama, Vedic literature's recommending fruitive activities, atmanam, and the self. Atasham karma kartrinam. Bhoktrinam sukadukayo nanatvam ata nityatvam lokakalagamatmanam atasham karmakartrinam bhoktrinam sukadukayo nanatvam ata nityatvam lokakalagamatmanam atasham karmakartrinam bhoktrinam sukadukayo nanatvam ata nityatvam lokakalagamatmanam. Chant, please.
Atasham karmakartrinam.
Atasham karmakartrinam.
Bhoktrinam
sukadukayo. Nanatvam ata nityatvam lokakalagamatmanam atasham karmakartrinam bhoktrinam sukadukayo nanatvam ata nityatvam lokakalagamatmanam.
Atesham karma kartrinam.
Atesham karma kartrinam.
Bhoktrinam sukadukayo.
Bhoktrinam sukadukayo.
Nanatvam ata nityatvam.
Nanatvam ata nityatvam.
Lokakalagamatmanam.
Atasham karma kartrinam.
Bhoktrinam
sukadukayo. Nanatvam ata nityatvam. Lokakalagamatmanam.
So we can chant the next two verses together.
Manyase sarvabhavanam samstayapatukiyata tatadakriti bhedena jayate vidyate chadi evamapyanga sarvesham dehinam deha yogata Halavaya Vata Santi Bhava Janmadayo Sakrit.
Translation. My dear Uddhava, I have thus explained to you perfect knowledge. There are philosophers, however, who challenge my conclusion. They state that the natural position of the living entity is to engage in fruitive activities, and they see him as the enjoyer of the happiness and unhappiness that accrue from his own work. According to this materialistic philosophy, the world, time, the revealed scriptures, and the self are all variegated and eternal, existing as a perpetual flow of transformations. Knowledge, moreover, cannot be one or eternal, because it arises from the different and changing forms of objects. Thus, knowledge itself is always subject to change. Even if you accept such a philosophy, my dear Uddhava, there will still be perpetual birth, death, old age, and disease, since all living entities must accept the material body subject to the influence of time. Well, this is a very philosophical verse and purport, so put your thinking caps on. We're talking here about the philosophy of Jaimini, Karma Mimamsa, or Purva Mimamsa, it's called. It's one of the six darshans, or six philosophies of traditional India. These are all very ancient philosophies. They were composed or produced around the time of Vyasadeva, or some even before that. In fact, Purva Mimamsa means the previous Mimamsa. Mimamsa means to study something very carefully. Analyze, analysis, you can say, Mimamsa. So Karma Mimamsa means an analysis of karma. That's called Purva Mimamsa, which means the previous Mimamsa. And Vyasadeva's philosophy, Vedanta Sutra, that's also called Mimamsa, but it's called Uttara Mimamsa, which means the latter, or it also can mean the higher, more refined or fulfilled Mimamsa. So here we're going to hear something about this Purva Mimamsa or Karma Mimamsa. It may be somewhat reminiscent of Krishna's talking to his father at Govardhan, because Krishna teaches that same philosophy at that point when he's trying to get his father to explain to him about the sacrifice they're about to perform. So Krishna speaks Karma Mimamsa philosophy at that point. So one thing I want to mention before we get into the purport as well. Here we're going to hear something about knowledge. It says this one of the points that the Karma Mimamsa philosophers make is knowledge, moreover, cannot be one or eternal because it arises from the different and changing forms of objects. So if you're like me when you read that sentence, it doesn't quite compute. What? What was that again? Knowledge cannot be one or eternal because it arises from the different and changing forms of objects. This knowledge itself is always subject to change. So I was reading this and also reading the purport, I started thinking about the concept of knowledge. What does knowledge actually mean? And the first thing that occurred to me is we talk about knowledge in two different ways. We have what we call knowledge, our own knowledge. I have knowledge of something. So that's one kind of knowledge. But then there's knowledge as a thing itself. You might talk about, I think it's in philosophical terms, it would be called the ontology of knowledge. What is knowledge? What is the thing that you call knowledge that you can have yourself? You can attain that. You can bring it into yourself. But it exists out there. So I went to the dictionary. This is from Webster's dictionary. And I see how it's broken down. They have four different definitions. Now the first one here, it has several parts to it. But it all has to do with the subjective experience that we call knowledge. My knowledge, you might say. So what is that? So here's some definitions of it. The fact or condition of knowing something. So that's knowledge. The condition of knowing something, that's subjective, that's my experience. Acquaintance with or understanding of a science, art, or technique. The fact or condition of being aware of something. The range of one's information or understanding, answer to the best For example, answer to the best of my knowledge. The circumstance or condition of apprehending truth or fact through reasoning. So another word for that is cognition. The fact or condition of having information or of being learned, a person of unusual knowledge. So you can see how this is all subjective. It's about my knowledge. So then the second definition here is the sum of what is known. So now you're talking about something that's outside. Those facts or the information that's outside. The body of truth, information, and principles acquired by humankind. So this, what the word that kind of summed it up for me here is information. The information exists out there. You can call that knowledge. It's a body of knowledge. Now this seems to line up with when jnana is spoken about as a philosophical principle in the Vedas, or vidya and avidya, also these terms are there. Vidya seems to be to correspond with jnana, especially when you talk about it in a philosophical way. So it seems to me that this is kind of what's being discussed here when it talks about knowledge. I'll read this sentence again. Knowledge cannot be one or eternal because it arises from different and changing forms of objects. So that thing that you call knowledge that exists out there on its own, the Kanamimansas say it can't be an eternal, definite thing. It's always changing because the knowledge that we perceive is always changing because we're always seeing temporary objects. So if you're not ready to leave, I'll continue. I'll start the purport here. It's good to try to stretch our brains once in a while, isn't it? Of course, I have a problem. I twist mine into knots sometimes. So purport. In this verse, according to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Lord Krishna speaks the following to Uddhava. My dear Uddhava, I have clearly established the actual goal of life in the instructions I have just imparted to you. There are those, however, who challenge my conclusion, especially the followers of Jaimini Kavi. If you are favorable to their understanding and thus do not accept my instructions, then kindly hear the following explanation. According to the followers of Jaimini, so this is all from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, the whole purport. Well, let's see. Pretty much, except the last paragraph. Let's see. Okay, continuing here, but this is what Vishwanath says that Krishna is saying. According to the followers of Jaimini, the living entity is originally and naturally a performer of fruitive activities, and his happiness and distress are derived from the fruits of his own work. And one thing I wanted to mention is, just like we have our Vedanta Sutra, and it begins, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, Jamadhyasya Yataha, right? What is Brahman? Now is the time for inquiry into Brahman. And what is Brahman? That from which everything comes. Well, in the Purva Mimamsa, it begins, Atato Dharma Jigyasa. Now we will inquire into Dharma. And then, I don't have it memorized, but I have it written down here. The second verse is, Chodana Lakshanorto Dharmaha. Duty is that which is indicated by the injunctions of the Vedas. In the Sarvasambhavi, the commentary, Jiva Goswami's own commentary on the Tattvasandarbha, he discusses a lot about Purva Mimamsa. The one thing is that the Purva Mimamsa has the benefit that it established how you study the Vedas and take knowledge from the Vedas, certain the procedure, you might say. And even Vaishnavas follow that same procedure for analyzing how you take the direct meaning and not the indirect meaning first and things like that. So there it's discussed how Jaimini Rishi and his followers, they say that the Vedas are completely injunctive. Injunctive means they're only about rules, you might say. They're completely about injunctions or rules, and they're not really meant to present any kind of philosophy about the absolute truth. This is the argument that the Kamsa philosophers make. So anything that you read that sounds philosophical, it's just sort of embellishment, you might say. It's really not that important. What's important is the rules. So that's why Tato Dharma Jigyasa, they're only interested in what is the Dharma. What are the Vedas trying to tell us to do? What are the injunctions? And So the idea is, that's all they're concerned with. Because they say that the jiva is naturally a fruitive being, as was mentioned here, and he just has to stay in this material world and try to be happy the best he can by following dharma. So let me continue here with the purport. The world in which the living entities find their enjoyment, the time during which they enjoy, now these are things that were mentioned in the translation. The world in which the living entities find their enjoyments, the time during which they enjoy, the revealed scriptures that explain the means for achieving enjoyment, and the subtle bodies through which the living entities experience enjoyment, all exist not only in manifold variety, but also eternally. The living entity need not develop detachment from material sense gratification. Now remember, this is their philosophy, not ours. The living entity need not develop detachment from material sense gratification, either by seeing the temporariness of individual material objects and situations, or by seeing the material world as an illusory creation. So don't try to be detached for these reasons. According to such a materialistic philosophy, material objects such as garlands, sandalwood, or beautiful women are temporary in specific manifestations, but perpetually exist through the natural flow of creation and destruction. In other words, although a particular woman's form is temporary, there will eternally be beautiful women within the material world. Thus, by carefully executing fruitive rituals according to religious scriptures, one can maintain enjoyable contact with women and wealth life after life. In this way, one's sense gratification will be eternal. So, you get the idea here, right? And you may say, well, you can't really enjoy because everything is temporary. That beautiful woman you have, she's going to turn old and die. So you can't enjoy her eternally. But they say, well, I'll just get another one. I get another beautiful woman. So then I can eternally enjoy beautiful woman. Not that specific one, but... So we go on here. The Jnani philosophers further say that there never was a time when the world did not exist as it does today, which implies that there is no supreme controller who has created it. They claim that the arrangement of this world is real and appropriate and thus is not illusory. So it is what it is. It's eternally a material world. It exists eternally, and you don't have to worry about who created it or where it came from or anything like that. Moreover, they say that there is no eternal knowledge of an original, perpetual form of the soul. In fact, they say, so now we get into this knowledge part here. In fact, they say, knowledge arises not from some absolute truth, but from the differences among material objects. Knowledge, therefore, is not eternal and is subject to change. The assumption hidden in this statement is that there is no spirit soul who possesses eternal, constant knowledge of a single, unchanging reality. Rather, the nature of consciousness or knowledge, now here these words are being used as synonyms, consciousness or knowledge, which is interesting because in the verse in the second canto that describes Vedanti tattvam yaj jnanam advayam. What is the absolute truth? Advaya jnana, which always struck me as the absolute truth is jnana, the absolute truth is knowledge. Now Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this, he explains that we're really talking about consciousness here in that sense. Even the idea of eternal full of bliss and knowledge. Sometimes you think, well, knowledge means that you know everything, you know, how many windows there are in the Empire State Building, or you know, some mundane facts. But it means fully conscious, is really what it means. Eternal, full consciousness, chit. Chit means cheto darpan margin, chit, or nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. It's about consciousness. So here they're talking, here he's talking, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is talking about knowledge or consciousness in that sense, what you're aware of. Rather, the nature of consciousness or knowledge is that it undergoes constant transformation. So they come in the monsters, they don't say that we have a particular consciousness that is ourself that doesn't change, even though there are so many things happening around us, our body changes, our experiences change, we remain the same. They say we change with our experience. There's no self in that sense. They state, however, that eternality is not refuted by the perpetually transforming nature of consciousness. Consciousness perpetually exists, they say, but not in the same form. Thus, the followers of Jaimini conclude that the transformation of knowledge does not negate its eternality. Rather, they state that knowledge eternally exists within the perpetual state, this perpetual nature of its transformation. So we're getting a taste here of what it means to be a philosopher. Philosophers, they exercise their intelligence with these things all the time. This is, of course, what our acharyas have done also. Studied these things very minutely and thought about them, and for someone like me with a small intelligence, I can't always grasp exactly what's being spoken of here, but it's good to, the exercise is good for the brain. Actually, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says, Siddhanta kriya chitti nakara alas. So don't be lazy in understanding Siddhanta philosophy. Because if you study it, it will strengthen your mind or your intelligence for remembering Krishna. So continuing here. Krishna is talking about the Kamini Mumukshus again. They therefore naturally come to the path of regulated sense gratification rather than the path of renunciation. For in the state of mukti or liberation, the living entity would not have any material senses, and thus the transformation of material understanding would not be possible. Such philosophers consider that the achievement of an unchanging state of mukti would stunt or paralyze the natural activity of a living entity, and thus would not be in his self-interest. Now, we agree with them on that. We don't want to go to mukti either. They're saying the soul, although they don't have the same idea as soul as we do with a living entity, is by nature active. So why would you want to go to mukti? You can't do anything there. Of course, their idea is they won't be able to enjoy material enjoyment anymore. We have a different idea of why we don't want to do nothing. We want to serve Krishna. The path of nivritti, aiming toward renunciation and transcendence of the material world, is naturally not interesting to such materialistic philosophers. Now, we always say there's a progression. You go from karma to jnana. That's the next higher stage. We realize the material world is temporary and it's full of suffering. So the Kama Mimamsas are arguing against that. So, why? We don't want to bother with mukti. It's not a desirable goal. We want to stay here and enjoy. Accepting for argument's sake the validity of such materialistic philosophy, one can easily demonstrate that the path of regulated sense gratification brings many unwanted and miserable results to the living entity. Now, this is what Krishna has said in the translation, in the verse. And of course, this is the point the prophet would always make, too. Dukalayam shashvatam. This world is miserable and temporary, and if you say, well, I'll just stay here and enjoy, but you can't stay here and enjoy. You'll be kicked out. You have to die. You'll be torn away from your enjoyment. So there's so much misery here. Therefore, even from a materialistic viewpoint, detachment is desirable. Material time is divided into different actions, such as days, weeks, months, and years. And by material time, the living entity is repeatedly forced to undergo the miseries of birth, death, old age, and disease. That such real miseries occur everywhere throughout the universe is well known. In this way, states Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Lord Krishna has pointed out the defect of materialistic philosophy to Uddhava. We may further elaborate that if one falsely accepts the atheistic philosophy of Jaimini and his innumerable modern followers, then the living entity perpetually remains entangled in the anguish of birth, death, old age, and disease. This bogus atheistic philosophy encourages material gratification as the only logical goal of life, but the living entity will inevitably commit mistakes in the execution of regulated sense gratification and eventually go to hell. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, personally tells Uddhava that this materialistic philosophy is false and irrelevant to the actual self-interest of the living entity. So it's nice Krishna has directly taken on this philosophy propounded by Jaimini Rishi. So Jaimini He's mentioned in the Bhagavatam in a few places. What's interesting about Jaimini, well, there are many things. One is that he's one of the disciples of Vyasadeva. So he's a direct disciple of Vyasadeva. And when Vyasadeva was dividing up the different branches of the Vedas, he gave the Samaveda to the care of Jaimini Rishi. And then Jaimini Rishi expanded the philosophy over time. They were spokesmen for these different philosophies, even into more modern times, elaborating on them, just like Vaishnava Acharyas have elaborated on the philosophy, fluffed out the cotton of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So Karma Mimamsa has also developed in that way. But at the root of it is Jaimini. So we may think, well, he's a disciple of Vyasadeva, but he's propounding materialism. But at the same time, he's the protector of the Samaveda. Now the Samaveda, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that I am the Samaveda. When he says I am this, I am that, so of the Vedic literature, I am the Samaveda. So the Samaveda is actually the most, and it is full of hymns of praise. Now often these hymns are disguised as praise of the demigods, but actually Krishna is meant to be glorified by these hymns. So the Samaveda is actually the most devotional of the four Vedas. The others have to do with, some of them have to do with, and one of them has to do with ritual and so on, esoteric things having to do with ritual. So Jaimini Rishi, we get a hint there, well maybe there's another side to Jaimini Rishi. Maybe he doesn't really believe what he's saying. He's on a mission, just like Shankaracharya was on a mission. So, to support this contention, we have the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Now Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Brihad Bhagavatamrita was written by Sanatana Goswami. And in the beginning of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Sanatana Goswami sets it up. He tells us what is this Brihad Bhagavatamrita? Where does it come from? So he explains that Janamejaya, the son of Maharaj Parikshit, he heard the Mahabharata at least twice, because there are different editions of the Mahabharata. Vyasadeva wrote it, and then it was repeated by different disciples of Vyasadeva. So the Mahabharata that we're familiar with today is the one spoken by Vaishampayana. Janamejaya heard from Vaishampayana the Mahabharata, but then he also heard from Jaimini Rishi the Mahabharata. So when he heard from Jaimini Rishi, he was in ecstasy. He said, wow, that was amazing. You said it so nicely. You told it so nicely, and you gave these hints about devotion that I didn't hear in Vaishampayana's. Can you tell me more? Can you kind of continue on this theme of devotion that was brought out in your rendition of the Mahabharata? But basically what he's asking for, you've heard of the Hari Vamsa. So the Hari Vamsa is like a continuation or an appendix to Vaishampayana's Mahabharata. Hari Vamsa, it's all about Krishna, the very devotional. We have many quotes from the Hari Vamsa directly about Krishna and devotional service. So basically, Janamejaya is asking for the same thing from Jaimini Rishi. Can you give me more of that nectar? You kind of gave me a little taste of nectar here in the Mahabharata. I want to hear a little bit more of it. So then Jaimini Rishi, he speaks Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And the story that he speaks is that after Parikshit Maharaj has finished hearing from Shukadeva Goswami, and he has just a little bit of time before he's going to be killed by the snake bird, his mother Udara comes to him and says, can you tell me what he told you? Can you give me like a synopsis of what you just heard from Shukadeva Goswami? And from that comes the Brihad Bhagavatamrita as we know it. So the Brihad Bhagavatamrita is very devotional scripture. I'm going to read a little something here from some of the commentaries by Gopi Pranadan Prabhu, who has taken this from Baladeva Vidyabhushana, who wrote a commentary on Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So here's a little something that he says. I found this quite interesting, actually. First of all, I'll read this verse. Well, maybe I should do this in order. This is from Brihad Bhagavatamrita, first chapter, first canto, or the first part, first chapter, verse number 12. This is from the commentary. The confidential message of the first part of this book, there's two parts to the book. The first is about Narada looking for the greatest recipients of Krishna's mercy. And the second part is the travels of Gopakumar all over the universe and eventually to Goloka Vrindavan. So the commentary says, the confidential message of the first part of this book will be conveyed through an ancient conversation between two exalted Vaishnavas, Jaimini Rishi and King Janamejaya. Okay, let me read, skip a little something. So Vyasadeva recognized Jaimini Rishi as an expert knower of the purport of the Sama Veda, which centers on devotional service to the Supreme Lord. Jaimini's teachings strongly emphasize the execution of sacrificial duties, but they do so to help understanding of the Vedas revealed in the Upanishads and the Vedanta Sutra. Jaimini is known too for his description of the glories of Lord Jagannath. Sri Janamejaya, a worthy son of Maharaj Parikshit, was also a pure devotee of Krishna. He had an ardent affinity for hearing about Lord Vishnu and the Vaishnavas. Out of eager love for the personality of Godhead and his devotees, Jaimini spoke the confidential topics of the Bhagavatamrita to Janamejaya. No material motive would have justified discussing such secret matters publicly. Then the next verse of Brihad Bhagavatam, or two verses later, after Janamejaya, the son of Parikshit, heard the wonderful Mahabharata recited by the sage Jaimini, Janamejaya was still eager to hear more, and so he inquired about the supplement to that topic. So this basically was what I just explained to you, a little bit of the history here. So then a commentary a little later. In the narration of Narada's search for the greatest object of Krishna's mercy, Janamejaya, this is the beginning of the second part. So now Janamejaya has heard the first part, Narada's search, and now he's asking, he wants to hear more. Janamejaya has enthusiastically drunk the exquisitely sweet nectar of the Bhagavatam. In other words, Bhagavatamrita, that's what it means. Nonetheless, his thirst is not yet quenched. Because Jaimini has mixed into this nectar the attractive fragrance emanating from his own lotus mouth, Janamejaya's thirst to hear has become so much stimulated that he cannot hear enough. And then in a purport, a commentary a few verses later, this is the last I'll read here. If, as Jaimini says, Krishna and his devotional service are beyond the mind and words, so this is one of the things Jaimini has said. Krishna's and his devotional service are beyond mind and words. So if that's true, how is Jaimini himself able to speak the sublime first part of Sri Brihad Bhagavatamrita? Jaimini answers that Shukadev Goswami, the son of Balarayana, Vyasadeva, empowered him. Jaimini was expert in many departments of Vedic knowledge and had deep realization of the absolute truth. Now in Karma Mimamsa, there's no discussion of absolute truth. That's not a consideration. The implication is, don't worry about that. Just enjoy the material world and don't think Janmad Yashayataha, that from which everything comes. So here it's saying that he was an expert knower of the absolute truth himself. He had deep realization of the absolute truth, Jaimini Rishi. But he was unable to understand and describe Krishna's glories on the strength of these qualifications alone. You might say he had jnana. Rather, he was empowered by the favor of the exalted Vaishnava Shukadeva. So that's why he could speak what he did, the Bhagavatamrita. Knowing that Jaimini was the only person fit to repeat the conversation between Parikshit and his mother, Shukadeva arranged for Jaimini to sit in a place that would be next to them so that he could hear the Bhagavatamrita. Since Jaimini heard it and was empowered by Shukadeva Goswami to understand it properly, the book has the potency to capture the serious attention of its readers. And because of having been transmitted by the mercy of exalted devotees, Sri Brihad Bhagavatamrita should be accepted as authentic revealed scripture. Sometimes the question arises, well, Sanatana Goswami wrote this, where did it come from, and so on. So Sanatana says this is actually an eternal scripture. And one point that Jiva Goswami makes in Tattva Sandarbha, or at least it comes up in the commentary, is that these literatures, they exist eternally. Just like we had the personified Vedas, so they're eternal persons. So the knowledge exists eternally in the spiritual realm. And the rishis, they can read those scriptures. They can bring them down to our level. Gopi Pranadam Prabhu would give the example that it's just like a radio transmission tower. So there's a big, so there's a signal broadcast from the radio station and it can't go all the way across the country. So at different places, there are relay stations that pick up the signal and then pass it on. So the rishis are like that. They pick up the signal from the original source, where it's always existing eternally, and then they pass it on to us. They bring it to us. So that's how we can justify Sanatana Goswami writing this and saying that it's true, it actually happened. I'm not making it up. Because he can see. He can read it, he can say. He can read into transcendence and extract that information and pass it on to our benefit. So my point in reading on that was to show another side of Jaimini Rishi. You may think, what? Jaimini Rishi is just a karmi. He's propounding this philosophy. Well, he has his reason. One of the things that came out in the commentary that it's helpful in some way. There's one place where Prabhupada says that all the paths, karma, jnana, and yoga, and of course ultimately bhakti, they all are purifying in one way or another. So even karmakanda has its purifying potency. So Jaimini Rishi is deputed to present this philosophy because it does have some purpose overall in Krishna's plan for our going back to Godhead ultimately. Alright, I'll stop here. Any discussion? Haridev Prabhu.
So would you say that the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, its good quality is to regulate society, regulate individuals, so, you know, if they follow these scriptural injunctions and stay within those regulations, then they'll get enjoyment, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, people get, they get used to following rules, basically. We see today, there's nobody follows rules. Even our society in the Western civilization in the last 50 years or so, there's no respect for any authority or any absolute. Of course, this is at the heart of postmodernism, where there's nothing is real or absolute. It's all subjective. It's all about your feelings and so on. So people don't want to control themselves. There's no self-control. People don't need any kind of discipline. Or they're not inclined to that. They're not trained that way. But the Vedic scriptures, they regulate. They give us discipline. Start thinking, no, I have to attain something, I have to control myself. So, yeah, they're important for that reason. And not only that, but also within the Vedas themselves, the Vedic mantras that glorify, as I said, they seem to glorify the demigods. There's one verse, I have it written down somewhere, I haven't memorized it. It's from the Vedas, where it says that all prayers are, all the names, all names are ultimately God's name. We borrow them from Him. So even the names of the demigods like Indra and Agni and so on, they're actually names of Krishna. Of course, you can take the word Indra, for example. What does Indra mean? It means the king. So who's the king? It's not the king of the tiny, puny heavenly planets. The real king is Krishna. He's the real king. So in that sense, all of these names, so even you can say, just like our acharyas, they sometimes take with the demons, say some bad thing about Krishna, and they take it as a good thing. So similarly in the Vedas, you think you're glorifying Agni, but Krishna's thinking, oh, they're glorifying me. That's one of my names. So even indirectly, there's that. And then, of course, the name Vishnu is also there in different ways. And the sacrifice itself has some purifying, elevating. Of course, it elevates you also up to the mode of goodness, which is more conducive for advancement in spiritual life, stepping stone into pure goodness. Yes, I do.
I'm thinking of, there's a common modern philosophical term, humanism, or human, I mean, is this kind of following in that same, or
in
can
some
you
ways
think of
it
other,
is, yeah. Humanism is, I think it tends to be atheistic at its core. Of course, there are strains of humanism in different philosophies. There can be Christian humanism, for example. But in the beginning, it's basically the idea is that human beings are the pinnacle of creation and everything is about satisfying their needs, their sense gratification, basically. So yeah, it's when you make that the goal of life, then you're missing whole background of transcendence upon which everything rests.
So Jaimini, when she was to, he created the commandments of philosophy to kind of bring people up to more maybe sattvic life. Then how does one, how do we make the next step? You know, I know like in Karmakanda, I guess maybe it's parallel to Karmakanda, in that the practitioner comes in the association of priests that may have bhakti, and then they get infected. This is an understanding on the yoga ladder, you know, by the commentaries of the acharyas in Gita. So is that, you know, how this is useful, and this is how he's performing service to Krishna, getting them to that point, and then they start intermingling with when they do their pujas and sacrifices, and then they come in contact with a Vaishnava.
Well, that's the key. That's the answer right there. But it's not that karma is the cause. There's no the mercy of the guru is causeless. So we can't say that we bring it on ourselves, you might say. In fact, in one sense, all of this wheel of karma, samsara, in one sense, it doesn't really help us. I just read this somewhere. It may have been in Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in that book where it has his condensed teachings, where this is something I've thought of a lot, is that it doesn't really help us to go through karma, because you keep doing it over and over. You're on this Ferris wheel. You go up and down, up and down, up and down, and you don't get anywhere. It seems like you don't learn anything. And I think it was either Bhaktivinoda or Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that that's true, because until the guru comes and tells you, hey, you idiot, you stop beating your head against the wall, this isn't going to get you anywhere. You have to get that transcendental vision, yadrichaya, which means basically somehow or other, by the mercy of Krishna. Krishna sends the guru to help you out. Now, why that is exactly, that's, Prabhupada said, you can't really explain. So it's just the inconceivable causeless mercy of the guru. But Karmakanda, in one sense, does prepare you. It's like the example that you can throw a spark in different places, throw it into the water, nothing's going to happen. But if you put it into a dry field of grass, it's going to blaze. So Karmakanda, in that sense, prepares you to receive the help of the guru. But until you hear from him, you're not going to figure it out on your own, really. Even if you're a jnani, you're only going to go so far. You're not going to get to bhakti, prema. Certainly not going to get to that. Madan stole the microphone. Right. Go ahead.
I was thinking of the word jibupsitam, that Narada means...
Jibupsitam.
Yeah.
Jibupsitam means condemned or horrible.
So there's that verse that he gave. Was he referring to this specifically? He says, the people in general are naturally inclined to enjoy, and you have encouraged them in that way in the name of religion. Verily, this is condemned and is quite unreasonable, because they will be guided under your instructions. They will accept the activities in the name of religion, will hardly care for the prohibitions. So Vyasadeva wrote what he's commentating on, so is this now the move?
Whether is Vyasadeva specifically referring to Jaimini's philosophy? Is it? Yeah, I don't know if he is. One thing that's interesting, what you're saying there is it shows that people only start thinking about the must be that sense gratification is good, because we're given all these ways to get sense gratification. So then they'll start thinking, well, why should I bother with doing all that stuff? I can get sense gratification. If that's the goal, why should I do all this hard stuff? I'll just go after sense gratification. Which, of course, is what has happened.
Did he get it from the Vedas, this information, and isn't Vyasadeva the one who wrote them all, the Vedas?
Yes, that's the idea that the that's what Jaimini Rishi has pulled up. Because there are all these injunctions on how to be happy, even in this world, so he's just extracted those out. And he's basically left out any kind of philosophy that might point towards transcendence. So he's taken part of the whole picture, you might say, and just emphasized it. Like Lord Buddha, he took a part of the picture and emphasized it. Didn't give the full explanation.
So this Udrichaya is basically, I mean, Bhaktivinoda Thakur gets into a thing where it's Bhakti and Mukhi Sukriti. So when they're doing this Karma Mamamsa or Karma Kanda, the Karma Kanda act, they inadvertently, maybe unknowingly perform activities that are pleasing to the Lord, and then that lays a foundation for the Guru coming into their lives.
Yeah, it's really a jnata sukriti too that especially prepares us to hear the message of the Vaishnava. It's like, well, sometimes when you preach to someone and the person, they say, well, that kind of makes sense, but I'm just not ready yet. I'm not ready to become a Hare Krishna and really accept this, even though it's kind of appealing. So their jnata sukriti hasn't accumulated enough yet. That makes, jnata sukriti makes you more inclined because they're always leaning one way or another. It's like one of those toys, you punch it and it comes back up. You know? We tend to go back to a certain position. So we want our inclination to be toward Krishna. The more we're also accumulating sukriti by the things that we do every day. I was telling Madan the other day, when I take Charanamrita, I always think Prabhupada gave that example. Little drops of water wear away the stone. He said, in this way I've written so many books. So I think little drops of Charanamrita to wear away the stone heart. Just every day I drop. I think, I wonder if I've drunk a bathtub full of Charanamrita in the last 40 years. So eventually this is worth accumulating punya. But it begins with the association of the Vaishnava. Otherwise you can't make the transition. You can't cross over into bhakti. It's too confidential. It's not that easy to get there into the realm of bhakti. Let me take someone else because Yamaraj Prabhu.
Thank you for the information, Prabhu. Toward the end of the translation, they talk about time. So now I know you read a lot and you hear a lot about, you get a lot of information. So I've heard, I don't know if this is a fantasy or not, or this is a lie or something, but the super rich people have created time machines. So
yeah, I don't know about time machines. The physicists say that time travel is impossible. They give different reasons for it.
So would the spiritual master, for example, they say Prabhupada, when he went to the Twin Towers, and he made a statement that was sort of like he had some view into the future about what happened there. And so, it was one devotee. I heard this. He said, Prabhupada said that I can't remember the exact details of it, but Prabhupada made a statement like he had some information that about the whole.
Yeah, I'll take that with salt. Sometimes devotees misinterpret. Prabhupada may have said, you know, this will be destroyed, because everything is destroyed in the material world. They built this huge skyscraper and it will be torn down. He would make statements like that all the time. And somebody might say, oh, that was a prediction. It wasn't a prediction exactly. So I don't know about that one. Of course, it doesn't hurt to think that Prabhupada, you know. One time a devotee sent me, he was writing about Prabhupada, and he had did some, like when in BTG, I try to, when somebody says Prabhupada said this or that, I'd like to find it on the database, or a person heard it directly from Prabhupada. So one time somebody said something, and I said, can you verify that Prabhupada actually said that? And the person's response was, well, it's something Prabhupada would say something like this. It's not, you know, it doesn't disagree with the kind of thing that Prabhupada would say. Well, I think I want to hear it, see it in black and white. Yes, Guru Prasad.
When Maharaj Parikshit heard the Srimad Bhagavatam, Then his version was the Bhagavatamrita to his mother, right? Isn't that what you said?
What Prachit spoke to his mother is Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Yeah,
yeah. But that's what he heard from Sukadeva Goswami.
Well, yes. Basically, if Brihad Bhagavatamrita is meant to present, you might say, all the philosophy of the Bhagavatam, all the real nectar, too, because it's very devotional.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what was there. Actually, it's interesting because it's meant to be a condensed version, but it's a long book. I guess when Jaimini started talking about, or Prachit Maharaj started talking about the nectar he heard, he also expanded on it himself. But what we find in Brihad Bhagavatamrita is that things are very nicely explained. Just like, for example, you take these higher planets, Mahaloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka. So we hear reference to them in the Bhagavatam, but we don't really hear anything about them, what really goes on there. But Brihad Bhagavatamrita, you do. Gopa Kumar goes there, and he meets the four Kumaras, for example, and they talk philosophy there. You get an understanding that one place is fire sacrifices going on all the time, another place are discussing philosophy. So he also kind of fluffed it out in that sense. But you can see how the whole progression and the trajectory is toward pure devotional service. And Gopa Kumar, especially in that part of it, well, even in the first part, we're hearing more and more depth about what prema bhakti is. So yeah, that's the, you can say that's the addendum to the Bhagavatam, or the addendum to the Mahabharata. Jaimini's version of the Mahabharata is the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the appendix.
I have to read it over, but when I read it, I thought it was just different grades of devotees, because, you know, first he goes to this one said this one is better, and this one is better.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about all the details. So I thought he was just comparing, you know, the different grades of devotees, which is not what I saw in the Bhagavatam.
Well, that's how he's presenting the philosophy. He's using that narrative to present the philosophy of the Bhagavatam. Because we see these people spread out in the Bhagavatam, but we don't see that there's actually higher and lower.
Right.
There's a hierarchy of devotees in that sense. So he's mapping it out for us. You know about Prahlad Maharaj. Well, here's how he fits in. You know about Uddhava. Well, here's how he fits in. And then, of course, at the very top, we have the gopis.
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, the beginning of the second part, Mother Uttara, she says, because at the end of the first part, and this takes a little time, but there's another Vrindavan is created. New Vrindavan is created in Dwarka. Lord Brahma creates a Vrindavan in Dwarka. So Krishna can, because he's lamenting, he's pining for Vrindavan. So Lord, I think it's Lord Brahma, right? He creates another Vrindavan in Dwarka, and Krishna enjoys there. So when Uttara hears about Krishna's Leela, Vrindavan Leela is taking place in this another Vrindavan, then Uttara, she's really excited about what she just heard, and she sees the exalted character, Vaishnava character of the Brijbasis, and then she's thinking, well, the Brijbasis, they must have something, but they must get some kind of special reward for their bhakti is so high. They can't, they're not like even these other devotees that we heard about. There's something more to say about this. So the second part launches from that, and then we end up with Gopa Kumar, of course, going back to Godhead, being received by Krishna, that wonderful scene where he enters back to Godhead, enters Goloka Vrindavan. And then there are verses, many, many verses, many of them quoted from the Bhagavatam about Goloka Vrindavan from the 10th canto. So it's the whole philosophy of the Bhagavatam, but it's done in this story format, which makes it really fun to read. Actually, it's a real nectar book, Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Radhika Raman Prabhu. Oh no, didn't you have your hand up? Or are you just stretching?
Huh?
Reaching for Goloka.
Oh, I can't refuse that. I forgot all about it.
It's written by Sanatana Goswami.
We're talking about causeless mercy of the guru and all that. But isn't that kind of in the sense it's not materially motivated, it's transcendent? I mean, this cause, you know, this desire, and then the cause is just to please Krishna, to bring this, the jivas into the...
You mean the guru coming is
just
not,
everything about
that's not
it,
material,
I mean,
motive, and that's why it's not causeless, is that what you're saying? Doesn't have a material cause.
Yeah, but the, I mean, obviously, I'm going on here, but, you know, in the pure devotional realm, there's desire, there's
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in that sense, yes, it has a cause. The cause is the devotee's bhakti. And the devotees are deputed by Krishna to give his mercy. He basically gives them power of attorney. He doesn't get directly involved. They're full of prema bhakti, and they're allowed to distribute it according to their own desire, according to their own hearts. So in that sense, that's the cause. Their bhakti, that's what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, his argument at the beginning of the Madhurya Kadambani, is that bhakti comes from bhakti. In that sense, it's causeless. It can't come, like I was saying, it can't come from karma. It comes from bhakti itself, and that bhakti is in the heart of the devotee.
It's pretty interesting how Jaimini has two missions, one to extract just the Dharma without the philosophy, and then he's got the other one to extract the bhakti, you know, from the Bhagavatam. You know, there's the essence of that.
So yeah, I mean,
I guess it kind of makes up for the Karma Mamamsa. For the other, it would be Bhagavatamrita.
It shows that devotees can, they serve according to the desire of Krishna. So Krishna wants them to do one kind of thing, just like Shankaracharya also, a nice example. What he did in one sense, you might say it's very distasteful what he had to do, preach Mayavad philosophy, which of course Lord Chaitanya thought was horrible, Mayavad philosophy, saying Krishna's deaf, dumb, blind, lame, so on. So what a horrible thing to say about Krishna. But Shankaracharya, at least he had to imply those kinds of things. Of course, we know on the side he let it slip with some devotional writings. That's the nature. But still, his service was to do that, so he did it. It's nice to see this, though, isn't it? It's nice to hear about Jaimini Rishi, how, what a pure, he was a pure devotee of the Supreme Lord, and this, the nectar was just gushing from his heart, because he was empowered, just like Shukadeva. He added to the sweetness of the fruit by touching it with his own beak, Shukadeva. So similarly, Jaimini Rishi also did the same thing, delivering Krishna Katha, adding to the sweetness by his own recitation or transmission of it.
So Anukul Yena Krishna Anu Shilanam Bhakti Uttama, it seems that we have to, even though Jaimini is presenting atheistic philosophy, he's rendering service to Krishna favorably as Krishna desires, so it's within the realm of pure bhakti.
Yes. Yeah. Obviously, he's just like Maya Devi. She's the epitome of that, you might say. She's tempting us. Usually if someone tempts you, you know, beautiful woman, this is like Haridas Thakur, who's tempted by seductress. So you think, oh, that's a horrible thing to do. So Maya's always doing that. The whole material world is Maya, the seductress. But why she does it, Chayeva Yasya Bhuvanani Bharati Durgah. She's so attuned to Krishna's desire that she's called his shadow. She moves exactly as according to his will. So that's a service to Krishna. All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.